Now, I'm delighted to say that on the line I have Phil Nihe from the Irish Nurses and Midwives Organisation, Phil being the General Secretary thereof. And Phil, before we start, congratulations on being appointed to the post. A bit late, but congratulations anyway.
Thank you very much.
Taking over from Liam Dorden, of course. Phil, we have a lot of people saying that we're charging ahead in Europe and we're the best boy in class and our economy is flying and everything is tickety-boo. We look at two issues which I think are going to form the cornerstone of the next election, one being homelessness and the other being health. Hundreds admitted to hospitals with no available beds last month. Phil, please discuss.
Yes, you're right. I think we recently, as part of the Congress of Trade Unions, were addressed by the Minister for Public Expenditure and Reform, Pascal Donohoe, and he said the two main items that he thinks about, I'm paraphrasing what he said exactly, were the two H's, housing and health. And they are obviously the two issues that are causing most concern to people who live in the country and who are trying to, I suppose, provide for their families housing, not just homelessness, but availability of accommodation. The numbers of families who are now homeless is hugely concerning. And people who would have an income, but rents are just absolutely extraordinarily high, particularly in the larger cities. In relation to health, the problem is that we now have insufficient beds for the numbers of people who are depending on the public health service. And as everybody knows, there has been a long debate over years as to whether we have enough beds, too many beds, and every Minister for Health that has occupied the position has had a slightly different opinion. So we finally now have a position where everybody's agreeing that we need more beds. We have the Sláinte Care report, which has cross-party support, and we should, in our opinion, therefore just get on with introducing additional beds into the system. And I suppose that's copper fastened by the figures of May of this year. Summer month, normally not the worst month, and this year it's really concerning from where we stand that the figures are so much higher than they have been in previous Mays. And that means that the winter is going to be even worse, without frightening everybody who's listening to this. But it would be extraordinary to have figures like we've had this May on trolleys.
Yeah, you're talking about 9,091 people, Phil, which is, I mean, at any time of the year, at any month of the year.
Exactly, at any time of the year, that's very, very high. But also, I suppose, the point is that so far this year, we have had 51,910 people on trolleys. And last year, for the entire year, we had just under 100,000. So from January to May, if we have almost 52,000, we know that the end of the year is always worse. We have the winter illnesses that cause people to require hospital admission. And until primary care is developed to a much greater extent, when we say primary care, what we mean is that services are available outside of the acute hospital. So at the moment, if you go to your GP and you need any type of a diagnostic test to establish what your condition is, or if you need further treatment, you have to be referred to the acute hospital. And everybody agrees that that's the wrong model, that you should have diagnostic testing available in the community, and also that some people are better off if they're cared for at home, but that requires a much bigger investment into the staff that you provide then to provide that care, nurses, home helps, etc. And right now we're really concerned, and the second press statement we issued this week was because we're currently in negotiations on how many extra nurses will you employ this year? The funded workforce plan is what they call it. And like, it's amazing that the HSE haven't submitted that to government yet, and it's June. And at the two meetings we've had with them, we're really concerned because the numbers are very, very modest, which means that we will not be able to develop outside of the acute hospital. And even in the acute hospital, we are not going to be able to put additional beds in place, because we just will not be able to staff them. So, for example, this morning I was talking to a number of our representatives in various hospitals, and one hospital has been told that they should now move to introduce at least 60 additional beds, but they do not have the authority to recruit because there is no funding available to recruit nurses. So the beds are no good without the staff. So this is, I suppose, this is what happens when you have a system like we have, where policy is derived at department level. Operationally, there are two different divisions, one the acute hospital, the other social care, dealing with everything outside of the acute hospital. The two divisions have different budgets, and they're competing budgets, and they're not integrated. So the whole model requires a complete and utter revamp, and that's why the problems are continuing to get worse.
Phil, can I just put something to you? And I'd like, and I know I've heard you address it in the past, and indeed several members or spokespeople for the INMO have addressed it, but just, can we put this one on the record? Just humour me on this one. Ty Daly from the Irish Nursing Homes has said that there are beds available in nursing homes which are staffed by fully trained nurses, which, while they're not the answer, they could be used as step-down beds, which in turn would free up some of the beds in the hospitals. Is this another example of the not joined up thinking?
Well, you see, I've heard that comment made by Nursing Home Ireland as well, but in reality, the people who attend the emergency department, who require the admission to an acute hospital, many of them come from the nursing home sector. So the nursing home is ringing the ambulance to bring the person to the emergency department. But those that attend as pure emergencies, obviously that's the service they need, not a nursing home bed. You then have the position of people who are finished with their acute phase of their illness. In other words, they need step-down care. And at any one time, you would have about 550, 600, creeping up again, people in that bracket. In other words, they're in the acute hospital because there isn't an appropriate area outside of the acute hospital to give them the care they need. The nursing home sector and the long-stay carers, health service executive-run facilities, in many instances, would say that the care that those people who are in acute hospitals but discharged require is not available in the service that they have. So in other words, there are obviously nurses working in private nursing homes, and we would, I suppose, have been on the record numerous times, have been very critical of the staffing levels. In other words, the skill mix. We believe that far more nurses should be employed in the private nursing home sector in order to be able to admit more complex need patients. But currently that isn't the case, and the nursing homes will assess prior to a decision to admit. And many times the units that are required for people who are being discharged from a long period of illness or an acute illness require intensive care in the community, and that requires a lot of nursing care. It requires, in many instances, still requires medication being administered intravenously. None of that is available in any of the services that are provided in many of the long stay units. It's improving. We've reached an agreement with the HSE on behalf of the state run care of the elderly facilities and long stay facilities, which promotes that the role of the nurse and the numbers of nurses employed in the locations outside of the acute hospital should be increased, and their responsibility for administration of medications and such like, which are part and parcel of nurses' roles in the acute hospital, should be facilitated. You need procedures, you need to ensure that that happens, because you don't have medical staff in many of these outside of the acute hospital, many of these hospitals and care units. So they're nursing-led units mainly, and they have some GP support, but there is no medical presence around the clock as you would have in the acute hospital. Having said all of that, what I'm what I'm basically saying is, undoubtedly, the services outside of the acute hospital have to be delivered at a much more higher level of care in order to take and admit patients with high acuity needs. Currently, the HSE tell us that they are unable to discharge to many of these private nursing homes because that simply isn't available to them.
Phil, we have an ageing population that is accepted, and I think probably one of the highest ageing populations per head of capita in Europe. 92 children waited on trolleys in 3 Dublin children's hospitals. That's a shocking indictment of any society, in my opinion. A man passed away and was dead for some hours in an A&E department, and I am not for one second casting any aspersions on medical staff present. It just actually, to me, highlights the pressure they were under when this wasn't noticed. That's a shocking indictment of our system. And Phil, the one thing that I have been absolutely itching to ask you for a long, long time. The budget for the HSE, to me, as a lay person, I'm not an expert, and I never claim to be, is, in my opinion, more than adequate to deal with our medical needs, but it is skewed totally the wrong way. I mean, I heard a figure at one stage that when it actually gets down to frontline services where it's needed most, there is something like 25% of it left.
Well, I think we can debate the budget over and back, and that's, I think, the beauty of having the Sláintecare report, which has cross-party support, because it confirms that the budget is not sufficient and that the budget has to be increased. Because whether we like it or whether we don't, the delivery of healthcare is very expensive, particularly if we want to be world-class at it. We want people to receive the most modern treatments. We want them to receive drugs that have just been proven to help their recovery. And if it is a matter of can we afford it, well, then that's not good enough. That will require big decisions around how we fund our health service, including what portion of our taxation, what portion of our PRSI, etc., should be red circled, purely to be used to promote and to have a world-class health service. And that's a decision for citizens. And I think all citizens should be looking to political parties and asking them, well, what is your plan for funding of the health service? And do you believe, for example, the tax you've recently put on sugary drinks and sugary goods, should that be red circled in order to fund the health service? For example, the revenue from alcohol, should that be? Because we know that many of those who attend EDs, particularly in the out-of-hours period, have a large percentage have attended because of the effects of alcohol and drugs, unfortunately. So if society's problem is that the health service is the only, the public health service is the right model, I think we all agree with that. We certainly do, representing nurses and midwives. We believe that the public health service should be publicly owned and should be publicly run, and that the focus should be on keeping the population healthy, and when they need emergency services, that they're there, that you get them, that you don't have to wait for 24 hours or longer in many instances, and that you get it as close as possible to where you live. So to bring all of that about and to bring about the change that that will need will be expensive and will require very serious decisions made by governments in respect of how they fund it. And we don't think that the answer should always be, look, there's no point in funding the health service because it's, as former politicians would have said, it's like putting money into a black hole. That is incorrect. In fact, our modern health service is good value for money if you look at it from the point of view of the increased mortality, the decreased mortality rates, the advances we've made in certain treatments, and the fact that all people who attend our health service say, when I get in, it's a good service. The problem is getting in and getting access.
But Phil, sorry for cutting across you, Phil. I am not for 1 minute disputing the work that's done and the quality once you get in.
Yes, that's my, the point.
My grievance is coming from, well, not even my grievance, but the point I'm putting to you is that the budget as it stands is more than sufficient to deliver a state-of-the-art health service, but the spending is being skewed. And irrespective of what reports say, I mean, it is blatantly obvious that there is a hierarchical system within the HSE which is made up of layers of bureaucracy, and that's absolutely eating up money.
Well, you can. I don't think we're going to argue about how many. We're definitely on the record as saying more funding should be spent in employing frontline staff. We absolutely agree with Joe on that point. But when you look at the overall funding and what the health service provides, I think that's the point I'm trying to make. Absolutely. We produced a report for the Public Service Pay Commission, for example, last November, where we gathered together all the statistics in respect of what types of numbers we've employed. Nursing and midwifery has gone down considerably since 2009. We're still trying to recover from that. And we're now spending more money each week on agency and overseas recruitment than we should be. There is an efficient way of using that money by directly hiring more nurses. And to do that, we have to bite the bullet and improve the pay for nurses and midwives to attract them to stay here, to attract them to work here, and to make sure that when they join the profession of nursing and midwifery, they can say, this is a good job, it's well paid, it allows me to have a decent standard of living, because that's not the case at the moment. And the other side of that coin is, therefore they leave, and they go to countries where they will have a better standard of living, and where they will have better compensation for the job they do, which is a very difficult job.
Yeah, and I mean, I thoroughly 100% agree with you on that. And I mean, the glaring example of that, and it's a country I know, I have personal knowledge of, and in fact, I have personal knowledge of the medical situation there, is Canada, where, I mean, nurses and doctors are far more highly valued and far more highly paid than they are here. And I mean, it really comes back to the other, where we started the discussion, Phil, in that the two H's, I mean, if you have... It's a shocking fact that, I mean, if you have a nurse, and we saw a study, you know, why anybody did it, because it was commonly known anyway, but nurses marrying guards and et cetera, but I mean, that was the standard thing. A nurse married to a guard and they're living in Dublin cannot afford a house in Dublin.
Well, that's right. The rents are just extraordinarily high, and the salary, the starting salary for our members, nurses who come out in first year post-qualification, they're very, very modest, 28,700. So,
and Phil, can I just stop you there, just on that one point. A nurse coming out in England, or a nurse training here, starting here, and looks at their pay packet and says, to hell with this, I'm out of here, and gets a job in a hospital in England, what's her pay packet then?
Well, you see, the hours are different, for starters. The nurse here works a 39-hour week to get her 28,700. In the UK, depending on where they work, but most Irish graduates go to big cities, they have a salary which is practically the same, but they get a waiting for working in a city. So they get a London waiting, or they get a... And that's an allowance in addition to their salary, which compensates for the cost of living. We don't have that in this country, and that brings the salary up and makes it very attractive. In addition, many of the employers in the UK have subsidised accommodation available, so they have maintained, for example, what were the old nurses' homes, and accommodation is available at subsidised rates. So it's a different comparator, but obviously we know that it is more attractive because many of our graduates are going there, and they're still going there.
A lot of people looked upon the Ministry of Health as a poison chalice, and in fairness, you know, it seems to have been a real pass the parcel scenario for the last couple of years. Simon Harris seems to be getting stuck into it, and you know, he seems to be trying to unpick and unravel it. Is this... And it's a comparison that I have heard on more than one occasion, Phil. you will never streamline the HSE because it's too big and it's like trying to service a jumbo jet in flight.
Well, I think that the point I made earlier about how the HSE is currently structured, we've just recently been asked to make a submission to government on the alignment of whether the hospitals should be separately funded and separately managed from the community care organisations, and we don't believe they should. We believe, for example, that we should be looking at the community services in conjunction with the acute hospital, not separately, and that it's very difficult to organise any delivery of healthcare when, for example, I'll give you an example. We were negotiating with a care of the elderly facility and the management team within it, and we were arguing to them that if they increased their nursing numbers and if they provided for additional advanced services that nurses could deliver, that that would save their budget. For example, you wouldn't require as many hospital transfers, and that requires the ambulance to transfer people. You also wouldn't require as many admissions to ED because the service could be provided in the care of the elderly facility. Much better for the patient. They're not put in an ambulance and transferred or moved and spending hours upon hours on trolleys. All of it makes perfect sense. And the response we got was, but that won't affect my budget. That'll affect the budget of the ambulance service in the acute hospital. So that, to me, encompasses the problem with the HSE. It is two separate organisations under one management team. And once that continues, we will continue to have that type of a response. And that's simply not good enough.
It would appear to me that Simon Harris should go out and invest in a good Hurley and beat some of these fellas into a room and sit them
down. Well, I wouldn't advocate that now.
And get them actually talking, Phil, because there just doesn't seem to be any joined-up thinking, and the left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing.
There are many good initiatives which nursing and midwifery have brought. At our conference this year, we showcased, I suppose, innovations that nurses and midwives have brought to the health service that don't cost money, that actually provide a much better service for patients, and that is what people want to do. I think when people invest in the health service, when they work in the health service, and I can only speak for nurses and midwives, but I don't think other disciplines are any different. They want to innovate. They want to bring about services that are better for the patient. That means, for example, if we can provide that service in your home, why wouldn't we? We have the skills. We are trained. So what's missing?
And it has actually been proven, I think, Phil, and I stand correct, or I can stand corrected on this if I'm wrong, that it is actually far, far cheaper.
Far cheaper. Makes way more sense and gives people a much better quality of life. Because, to be honest, and unless you have experienced a period spent on a trolley in an ED or accompanied a relative or a loved one, you don't understand what that actually means. And again, I was in one of our hospitals last week. I was meeting a group of ED nurses. We were walking through the ED department, the emergency department, and I was able to hear very intimate and clinical details being presented to people on trolleys by their medics who had no choice. They actually had no choice because that is the only facility that's available. And that's not good enough.
Well, it certainly isn't good enough, Phil, when you...
There is no privacy, and our colleagues in the medical profession, ED doctors and ED consultants, are saying this over and over again. The lack of dignity associated with being cared for on a trolley and the lack of human rights that are associated with it shouldn't just be passed over as if, oh yeah, we know that's happening and it's terrible. We actually have to try and correct this. So at the moment, I suppose what we're doing is, and I think the reason we're doing it is, we want to make sure that it's never off the agenda. We count these trolleys on a daily basis to ensure that everybody knows this is not good enough.
Yeah, but again,
not only are people on trolleys and inappropriate spaces in EDs, they're also on trolleys and inappropriate areas on wards now. So the overcrowding issue is spreading from the ED departments throughout the whole hospital to the tune of 9,000 for the month of May. We know we need more beds, but now we need to get on and put them in place and get the nursing staff employed to staff them. Yeah, otherwise, you'll be ringing me again this time next year and we'll be having exactly the same conversation.
Well, we will, Phil, but the problem is that the 9,091 could very easily be 15,030 at that stage, you know, and this
well, if the increases that have happened over the last number of years, there's an 18% increase since this time last year. So we know that it hasn't improved.
It's only going one way. And it goes back to what I said, no, okay, tongue-in-cheek, but I mean, really and truly, these people need to be sat down and explained to them, listen, it's not about protecting your little bit of autonomy because you have a budget here and this isn't going to help your budget or affect it. This is an ambulance problem. It is all, as you say, under the one umbrella. So until such time as they start talking and liaising, and as you said, there are, without turning the QE2 around in the Dunleary Port, there are pretty simple steps that could be taken to streamline this.
I think what people listening to your show should understand that, and in the main this is the case, the people who go to work at the health service, and obviously I represent nurses and midwives, but I think it is fair to say that most people who go to work in the health service go with the intent of doing good. And they want their environment to be such that they can innovate, that they can provide better care, and that the people who attend for service get a prompt service, get a very accurate service, get a very good service. And they are tired, and particularly the people I represent, on a regular basis tell me they are really tired of apologising to the public for matters that are outside of their control. And I think that we need, those of us that work representing those in the health service, we need to ask the public to support those that work in the health service in the front line particularly, because without the public support, it's probably not going to change very quickly.
And it's a funny thing, Phil, and I just want to finish on this note that, you know, for a long period of time now, 10 years maybe plus, we have been complaining about the health service in this country, or the HSE in this country, and the way, you know, as you said, the situation in relation to beds. In all the coverage of that, I have never yet heard a complaint about a nurse or a doctor in A&E or in a hospital. It has always been about the bureaucracy and the red tape, never about the frontline staff. So, I mean, they are, your organisation is a credit.
Patient survey, the HSE have started doing patient surveys, and when you read that, that is the common theme. The common theme is, oh my God, they're doing their best. There's, you know, the workload here is incredible. Like one nurse looking after 16 patients, one nurse looking after, you know, on night duty, for example, looking after 20 patients in some occasions. I mean, that's simply unsafe. The public should expect more. The public are entitled to more. And from a health and safety workplace point of view, if you were on a building site, that wouldn't happen. The equivalent wouldn't happen. It wouldn't happen in the aviation industry. You wouldn't fly a plane with 20 people standing in the middle.
And Phil,
so why are we allowing it happen in the health service when people's lives are the outcome?
And Phil,
we believe fundamentally we have to shift the focus. This is a real crisis. And we have been advocating that part of the answer is you have to get more staff. And you have to ensure that when staff are employed, that you can keep them. And you will never keep them if you continue to treat them as low-paid workers, which is what's happening in nursing and midwifery. It's a female-dominated profession. It is a low-paid profession. And that has to change. Because otherwise, they will continue to go abroad, and we will continue to be short.
And Phil, just before we go, and we are out of time, but I just want to go back over that last point you made, where you were talking about one nurse to 16 and one nurse to 20. What's the national or the international accepted ratio?
Well, we know from a study we recently did here in Beaumont Hospital and in Our Lady of Lourdes and Drogheda that once one nurse has responsibility for more than 8 patients, the patient outcomes deteriorate. In other words, mortality increases. I mean, this is just incredible research that UCC has recently conducted. The safe level for patients is between 1 to 4, depending on how sick that patient is, or 1 to 6. Once you tip over 1 to 8, you're heading into very dangerous territory. And we have regularly in this country exceeded that amount, regularly. And the ward I was in last week, when I was in that particular hospital, the night before, there was one nurse for 17 patients.
And that's
simply not safe.
That's a long way from one in four or one in six. Phil Nighy, thank you so much for joining me this morning, Phil. It has been brilliant. Sorry for holding you up so long, but, you know, as you can well appreciate, it is a topic that everybody is interested in because it will affect everybody. And if it hasn't, it certainly will. Phil, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Bye-bye.